The title of my sermon today is We've Got Laws and There Are Laws. It's going to be a comparison between the laws of God and the laws of mankind, secular laws that we have in our nation, other nations have, that they go by and they instruct their citizens how to behave. There's a huge difference between the laws of God and human laws. Most people never understand that distance. And so most people tend to view God's laws in the same way that they view human laws of the society in which they live, whatever nation they live in. In many cases, this perspective may not be a problem. But there will inevitably also be occasions when the attempt to apply God's laws in the same way that we apply human laws will be a serious mistake. Those occasions will expose a major lack of understanding regarding the laws of God. Lawyers epitomize the problems that are inherent in human laws. Lawyers argue about laws and how those laws should be applied. A lawyer asserts that a certain law requires action X. Another lawyer will assert the law in question does not apply and that action X should not be taken. Lawyers can look at the exact same law and then reach completely different conclusions. That is exemplified in the way our Supreme Court functions. You have 9 lawyers, very educated, very intelligent, and they look at the same law when a case comes before the Supreme Court in the United States, and they come up sometimes with a 5-4 decision. They come up with 6-3, 7-2, 8-1. And these are people that are looking at exactly the same law with the same background in law, knowledge, and understanding. But they don't come up with the same answer. Most of the time, those 9 judges on the Supreme Court cannot reach unanimous conclusions, even though they're all supposedly looking at the same laws. This is not a good situation. At the heart of situations like this, with supposedly trained lawyers reaching completely different interpretations of the exact same law, lies the difference between God's law and human laws. So let's take a closer look at that difference. The premise for human laws are established as they are perceived to be needed. The purpose for human laws is to regulate human conduct and human actions in such a way that people will no longer engage in actions that are deemed to be unacceptable. But there is nothing that ties all human laws together under one umbrella, as it were. So people live together in a society, and something happens that is unacceptable or just plain bad. These people make a law to try to prevent those unacceptable things from happening again. Then something completely different happens, which is also deemed to be bad. So people then make another law to prevent this new unacceptable situation from happening, or at least to present a deterrent for anyone to also engage in this unacceptable conduct. Then another situation leads to another new law. The process is endless. We've had a couple of those recently. Mr. Quinn was telling me on the way up today that he just noticed that the town of Troy, Pennsylvania, which is 40 minutes from where we live, had just enacted a law to prevent the establishment of any business that sells pornography in the city. It's a good law. But they wanted to do it before they established pornography selling business in town, because once the business is set up, it's really hard to get them to not function. If you get the law there, you can't do it. Now, lawyers are going to argue about that down the road, but that's later on. Another law that I just noticed this morning, and it's a really good law, maybe it's yesterday, but they've made a law in Pennsylvania that every bridge overpass has got to have a fence up so that you can't throw things off the bridge. The reason for that is a lady from Ohio and her family were traveling out of Pennsylvania Turnpike or interstate. Somebody threw a big rock off the bridge. I know, probably kids, and I've done kids things too. They weren't thinking. You know, and that's part of what the sermon's about, is thinking. But they were trying to hit a moving target. You know, car's coming, throw it now, we can hit them. Not thinking that there were people in that car, and the big rock went through the windshield, smashed a lady, the mother, in the head, and just totally ruined her life. She almost became a vegetable. She almost died, but her life is really totally ruined because of that rock smashing into her head from some senseless activity. So they make a law. Now they can't do it because they're going to require tax dollars to build these big fences so that you can't throw a stone over it. We have about 20,000 laws in the United States just governing the use and ownership of guns. That's 20,000 different laws for one small area of life. And they want to make more. Every time there's a mass shooting like there was a couple of days ago down in Baltimore, people are hollering, got to get rid of those automatic rifles. Well, it happened in this case, I guess a guy used a shotgun, but still, they're going to be screaming about more laws. The number of pages for just the laws relating to the subject of taxation exceeds 80,000 pages. Just for taxes. From 2000 to 2007, Congress created at least 452 new crimes by writing a law saying this is a crime. Things that were not deemed to be crimes before the year 2000. Now there are in total more than 4,450 laws different, describing different federal crimes. Nobody knows exactly how many laws we have in total, though it is far in excess of 100,000 and very likely far in excess of 200,000. Compared to the 31,175 verses in the Bible, we have far more than four times as many laws as there are verses in this Bible. That's a lot of laws. When people are elected to the House of Representatives, then creating new laws becomes their most important job. That's why in the eight-year period from 2000 to 2007, Congress establishes 452 new crimes to prove that they're good lawmakers. Elected members are constantly looking for excuses to create new laws in an attempt to justify their status as members of Congress. Theoretically, all of our 100,000 plus laws are based on the Constitution, but that's certainly not the case. In fact, many of our lawmakers either don't understand the Constitution correctly or they reject the Constitution and actively seek to undermine it. It's just a fact. Clearly, this endless process of creating new laws is totally out of control. When we consider all of our laws in their totality, the most striking feature is that there are nothing that those laws have in common. There's no inherent quality guiding principle that ties them together. There's no relationship between laws that regulate taxation, laws that regulate the ownership of guns, laws that regulate employment, and laws that regulate food production, laws that regulate health services, human business practices, laws on aviation designed to regulate the environment, and all of our seemingly endless other laws. There's just no end. In practice, the majority of our 100,000 laws have nothing to do with the Constitution. The premise for creating new laws seems to be we need to have laws, new laws, to make our life better and safer and fairer. We think that laws are supposed to solve problems. But in actual fact, laws have never solved any problem. And so Congress just continues creating more and more new laws. And it's an endless, futile progress, a process, like a dog chasing its own tail. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that all our laws are built on the foundation of our Constitution. Even if that was the case, which it is not, we would still have problems with those laws. To see how these problems come into the picture, let's consider the process. We have three co-equal branches of government in the United States. The legislative branch, Congress, which makes new laws and repeals or modifies existing laws. The judicial branch, or the courts, interprets the laws regarding how they should be applied. And the executive branch, or the president, enforces the laws made by Congress. This is a major source of a lot of our problems. People who think up and process new laws, in other words, Congress, obviously have something in mind which they hope their new laws will achieve. So with their specific goals in mind, they sit down and figure out the wording for their new laws. The words they use express the thoughts in the minds of the lawmakers, at least theoretically. Having put their laws into words and getting them passed into law, those laws are taken out of the hands of Congress. Then those laws become the responsibility of the judicial branch. Now, when a lawsuit involves one of these laws comes before the courts don't go back to the original lawmakers and say, what did you mean when you wrote this, with this particular sentence or paragraph or phrase? They don't do that. In fact, they can't do that. The courts then decide on their own, without any assistance from Congress, how that law should be interpreted. And the courts don't care whether their interpretation agrees with the original intent of the law. There is no recourse for the original lawmakers to ever say to the courts, listen, that's not how we intended that law to be used, or the specific wording of that. The intentions underlying a specific law have very seldom had any influence on how the courts will interpret and apply the law. It's the exception and not the rule when the courts correctly apply the original intention of the lawgivers who created the law in the first place. The precise wording of the law becomes the most important deciding factor. The key approach here is the law says, and it's the precise wording of the law that the lawyers debate. Not what the law was intended for, but what it says. It's kind of like President Bill Clinton back in 99, I think it was, when he was before Congress impeached, facing impeachment, and he had lied to Congress, and they questioned him about that lie, and he said, well, what really matters is you have to understand what the meaning of is. So he was turning, he was a lawyer, and he said, you got to know what the meaning of the word is to know whether I was lying or not. And So there's a disconnect between the people who create the laws to deal with very specific situations they have in mind and the people who choose to interpret the application of those laws to get around something else. The courts have the power to apply laws to circumstances and situations to which the original lawgivers never intended their laws to be applied. lawgivers are in fact powerless to prevent their laws from being applied. Unless they repeal it, and that's a long and involved process. It can change it, but from a lot of the things that we've seen about government trying to reverse or repeal different laws that were passed in the last 8 years, it doesn't work so good. They still haven't gotten it done. The main point to grasp is that the courts frequently apply laws in ways that are in conflict with the intent of the original lawgiver. Literal wording of a law has become the supreme criterion of how the law will be interpreted by the court. No lawgivers are able to anticipate all the possible situations, circumstances that may arise in the future. Therefore, when new circumstances arise, it's easy for laws to be used that are in conflict with the original intention of the law. Consider a biblical example, and we've got biblical examples. I'm just going to quote a couple of them. But in Daniel chapter 6, you can turn there if you wish. Daniel chapter 6. I usually, sometimes, not every message, but quite often, I use this as an example. No matter what I say or what any other man says, the scripture tells us in one place to let two or three people speak and the rest of you judge. What are you supposed to judge? You're supposed to judge what the speaker says against what's in this book. If it doesn't match, you throw out what I say or what anybody else says. It's got to match this book. That's what the Bereans did. They went back to the scriptures and searched them diligently whether these things were so. And that's your job. My job is to present the scriptures as clearly as I can, and you judge. Biblical example. Daniel 6 and verse 6. We'll start there. I won't read all of it. We'll cover it kind of hit and miss. And then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdoms and the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have counseled to together to establish a royal statute, to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, he shall be cast into a den of lions. 120 princes, political leaders of the Persian Empire, wanted to have Daniel killed. That was the whole intent and purpose for this law. So they tricked King Darius into signing a flattering decree that nobody in the whole empire would be able to ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days except you ask of King Darius himself. Darius succumbed to the flattery and signed the decree, which according to the law of the Medes and Persians could not be changed or reversed. See Daniel chapters 6 through 9. So we can read 8 and 9. Now, O king, establish this decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, what did he do? He went up into his room, in front of an open window, and prayed to God three times a day, morning, noon, and night, even though he knew the law was in effect. The 120 leaders knew that Daniel would pray to God every day, so they caught Daniel praying. Pretty easy, you just watch. And they pressured Darius to have Daniel thrown into the den of lions. When Darius realized he'd been tricked, he was sore displeased with himself. and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. That's Daniel 6:14. Here was the extreme supreme ruler of the greatest empire at that point in time on the earth. And he was powerless to do what he wanted to do. He was powerless because no decree or nor statute which the king established may be changed. There was no flexibility of any kind. The one who had signed the law had no control over how that law might be applied by other individuals, and he couldn't even issue a royal pardon. When Darius signed the law, he had no intention of preventing Daniel from praying every day. Daniel's situation didn't cross the mind of Darius when he signed that flattering but perverse decree. We all know the story. He threw him in the lion's den. But the bottom line, this story is, here was a law that was applied to the situation which the actual lawgiver had no intention of applying it. In fact, the lawgiver himself strongly opposed the circumstances to which this law was applied. In this case, the problem was not that the people who provided the wording of the law, those 120 princes, had any. In this case, the problem was that the people who provided the law had a devious intentions for applying the law. The intentions that they kept well hidden from the actual lawgiver until it was too late. This is a very common and familiar process in our age. One of the deviously securing the passage of laws that would never be approved if the hidden implications of those laws were openly exposed to the voting population. You've heard the phrase in the last 8 or 10 years, let's just pass the law so we can then find out what's in it. Because it was 1,200 some pages long and nobody wanted to read it ahead of time. The point is this. If the actual wording of a law becomes the overriding criteria of how the law must be applied, this inevitably will create undesirable results for some future situations and circumstances. With human laws, the actual wording of the law becomes the final judge of what is right or what is wrong. With human laws and the intentions underlying the creation of a human law take a distant second place to how the actual wording of the law can be interpreted. The wording always takes priority over the actual intention. That's how human laws always operate. And that's how the law Darius had signed operated. The law he had signed turned out to be a huge problem for Darius himself, because under no circumstances did Darius desire to see Daniel killed. Let's look at another example. King Solomon. Solomon was about 14 years old when he succeeded his father David as king over Israel. Some of his half-brothers, who were all older than Solomon, and had also hoped to succeed David. One of them, Adonijah, started plotting to overthrow Solomon. Basically, Adonijah plotted to have Joab, the leader of the army, on his side. Also, Abiathar, one of the two top priests, on his side. So the plot for removing Solomon from being king was for Adonijah to have the backing of the military, Job, and the backing of the religious leadership, Abinijah. But the key component that was left in this plot to take over the kingship from Solomon was to have King David's last wife, in other words, Agashai the Shumanite, become Adonijah's wife. This may not make sense from our perspective today, but Adonijah's attempt to get Abishag to become his wife was aimed at consolidating Adonijah's claim to the throne over his younger half-brother Solomon. Adonijah knew that the people of Israel would also see it that way. In cases where the succession was not from father to son, it was a common practice for a successor to take over some of the wives of the previous ruler. As God told David through the prophet Nathan, after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, I give you, God said to David, and I gave you your master's house and your master's wives unto your bosom. And I gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I moreover would have given you such and such things. God had given David some of Saul's wives when David became king. That action, David taking over some of Saul's wives, also consolidated David's position as king in the eyes of the people of Israel, because that's what the kings used to do. Adonijah's request for Abishag was of that precise motivation, to strengthen his claim to the throne. Bathsheba was very naive and did not understand Adonijah's real motivation. So Adonijah deviously persuaded Solomon's mother to ask Solomon that Abishag might be given to Adonijah. Adonijah had figured that Solomon would be caught off guard and not deny his mother's any request. For he will not refuse you, in 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 17. And sure enough, Solomon's mother was totally deceived by his real intention, and she naively approached her son with this request. Notice the context, the point that concerns us in our context. Bathsheba said to Solomon, I desire one small petition of you. I pray you, say me not nay. 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 20. Here's the reply King Solomon gave to his mother. And the king said unto her, ask on, my mother, for I will not say you nay. I'm not going to tell you no. Tell me what you want. We'll take care of it. Here the king gives his word to his mother that he will not deny her request. Solomon made this commitment to his mother in the presence of other people, so there was no way for him to later deny the promise that he had made to his mother. So now Darius and Solomon were tricked. Darius was tricked into signing a stupid law proposed by people with devious intentions. Solomon was tricked by Adonijah into committing himself to fulfill his mother's, Solomon's mother's, request without knowing in advance what that request would be. Both of these kings made commitments in good faith, unaware of what they would be, unaware of the perverse ramifications that these commitments would have. In the first one, Darius was unaware that Daniel would be killed, with Solomon, that Solomon himself would be overthrown. Having made this totally unconditional commitment to his mother, what did Solomon do once he found out that what her request was? Did he say, well, I've already given my word that I would fulfill her request? And think also in this regard about Herod when he asked for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. So I guess that's what I got to do. It was asked for and I said, I got to do it. Is this what Solomon did? No, of course not. Solomon had wisdom. Solomon was already aware of Adonijah's plotting with the military, with Joab and the priesthood through Abathar. And Solomon immediately understood the real reason why Adonijah wanted to have Abishag as a wife, namely to consolidate his claim to the throne. So instead of keeping his promise to his mother, Solomon immediately had both Adonijah and Joab put to death. And Abathar, who was also worthy of death for plotting to overthrow the king, was banished from Jerusalem. Plotting to overthrow the God-selected king reaps the death penalty. Human lawyers would argue that Solomon obviously broke his word, and therefore they would pronounce Solomon guilty in this matter. And that is the fact that some commentators reason erroneously that this incident made Solomon a murderer. But that is not true. Solomon himself felt no obligation of any kind to keep his promise to his mother. Breaking his word in these specific circumstances. Didn't bother Solomon a bit. And here's the lesson for us. With human laws or promises made, the literal wording takes priority over the actual intentions underlying the wording of a law or a promise. The godly approach for underlying, with a godly approach, the underlying intentions always take priority over the actual words that are used. With a godly approach, people can never be tricked into making unintentional commitments because of the way something was deviously worded. Coming back to Solomon, the underlying intentions in Solomon's promise to his mother were not to deny her anything that was good, that was honest, that was just, that was pure, sincere, and right. Under no circumstances was Solomon, at the point in his life, prepared to grant his mother any request that was bad, that was evil, that was unjust, hypocritical, or just plain wrong. Solomon didn't spell it out to his mother, but that was implied. He didn't say, if you ask anything that is good and right and just, I'll certainly do it. But if you ask anything that's evil and unjust, then I won't do it. This was the obvious premise on which Solomon made his promise to his mother. That's also how God does it. When Jesus Christ said, you shall ask whatever you will, in John 15, verse 7, it shall be done unto you. And when he said, whatsoever you shall ask the Father in my name, he will give it to you, in John 16 and verse 23. This was on the obviously implied premise that the things we ask for are good and honest and just and true. The underlying intentions of all these promises that Jesus Christ presented in the scripture always take priority over the actual wording of the promise. Underlying promises are not always spelled out, but they don't need to be spelled out. But with all of God's laws and God's promises, the underlying premise always takes priority over the words that are used. And here's why. Words can be twisted, they can be misapplied, they can be used in ways that are not intended to be used. Underlying premises, on the other hand, are not subject to change and can't be twisted to achieve undesirable consequences. Let's consider the Sabbath commandment in that regard. A part of the Sabbath commandment reads, in it you shall not do any work. Typical human lawyer reasons, we need to define what we mean by work. And once we've defined what constitutes work, then we can establish what is permitted on the Sabbath and what is not permitted on the Sabbath. And that approach is dead wrong. That approach doesn't ask about God's intention for this commandment. In fact, the approach doesn't even care what God's intention for the commandment. The only thing a carnal human approach asks is how must we define work? The carnal human approach to this law of God is exemplified by the hypocritical scribes and Pharisees. Their hypocritical approach was to judge healing people on the Sabbath as work. And therefore, supposedly breaking the commandment, likewise their hypocritical approach was to judge picking a few random ears of wheat on the Sabbath and eating the grain as work. And therefore, supposedly breaking the Sabbath. God's laws are not defined by words. All of God's laws are defined by two great principles: to love God above all else and to love everyone else as we love ourselves. The wording we have in the Bible for every single law of God is intended to express applications of one or both of these two great principles. The words of a law of God don't define the law. The words are only the tools to try to convey certain specific applications of a way of thinking that always puts the love of God and the love of fellow man ahead of self-interest. And every law, God's intention for that law immensely exceeds the limits presented by the actual wording. With God's law, the two great principles are everything. And if the wording of any law can ever be construed to go against one of these two great principles, then we are clearly applying that wording of that law in a way that is contrary to God's original intention for that law. If the situation, the wording of the law must yield to God's original intentions. That's what the whole Sermon on the Mount was about, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Every example Christ presented in that situation shows that a law's application far exceeds the actual wording of the law. And you can study through that, and every law that he quotes, he goes on to explain the spiritual intent of that law. Jesus Christ was the one who spoke the words from Mount Sinai in the days of Moses. That's why he is the Lord of the Sabbath, Mark 2:28. And during his earthly ministry, he knew exactly what was right for the Sabbath and what was not right for the Sabbath. Jesus Christ did not ever attempt to provide some kind of definition for work. How do you define work? It's secondary to what are God's intention for the Sabbath. How do you define is a kind of the same question. Notice what Jesus Christ said to the Pharisees who were critical when Jesus Christ healed people on the Sabbath. And he said unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day, or to do evil, to take life, or to kill? But they held their peace. Mark chapter 3 and verse 4. Christ directed this question to the Pharisees. But the Pharisees didn't answer, and neither did Christ himself provide an answer. So let's now look at clearly the answer to that question that Christ didn't verbalize. Number one, it's always, including on the Sabbath day, lawful to do good. Always. It is never, on any day of the week, lawful to do evil. Number three, it is always, including the Sabbath day, is lawful to save life. Four, it is never, on any day of the week, lawful to kill. Now ask yourself, why did Jesus Christ ask this question? What was his point? The point of the question is the word work does not define God's intention for the Sabbath. Whether or not doing good constitutes work doesn't enter into the picture. Likewise, whether or not saving life constitutes work also does not enter into the picture. This is where God's laws are totally different from human laws. If the Sabbath commandment was only a human law, then lawyers would most assuredly argue about whether something or something is or is not work. But from the point of view of Jesus Christ, the one who established the Sabbath commandment, there was a far greater focus than whether or not something constitutes work. There are motivations that supersede the question of work. For example, reaping your crop on the Sabbath is work. It is not an acceptable activity for the Sabbath, but going out into your garden on the Sabbath and picking a tomato or an apple for immediate consumption is perfectly acceptable. For that matter, if there are a bunch of people at your house and six or eight, say, and you're quite acceptable to pick a half a dozen pieces of fruit for snacks or part of the morning meal, that is not considered work in the eyes of God. This sort of dozen pieces of fruit for snacks or part of a mighty meal is simply not what God means when he says work. The motivation for picking a few pieces of fruit in this situation is completely different from the motivation of anyone who picks the same number of pieces of fruit for the purpose of selling them in an organic farmer's Sunday garden, Sunday market. In these situations, the motivation and intentions are everything. But try to argue that in a human court of law, where they consider nothing other than the literal wording of the law. Consider also God's instruction for the Sabbath in Isaiah 58, verses 13 and 14. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words. In these instructions, God simply does not mention work. Certainly we are not to work on the Sabbath, but the things God focused on here in Isaiah 51, verses 1 through 3, or 13 through 14, didn't appear anywhere in the commandment in Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. And with human laws, it would be difficult to argue from the point of Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11, with the intention of arriving at Isaiah 58, 13. We have already always referred to these expanded application of God's law as the spirit of the law. And we should have known about the spirit of law for a long time. The expression, the spirit of law, tells us that the literal wording of the laws of God can never adequately express the actual instructions and intentions of that law. Jesus Christ repeatedly illustrated this on the Sermon on the Mount. For example, the wording of the law says, you shall not kill. Cannot properly or possibly cover God's actual intention. God's intentions are that we must not entertain the emotion of anger and rage. Similarly, the law, you shall not commit adultery. God's intentions are that wrong thoughts of lusting are also a violation of that law. What God is teaching us is how to think like he does, so our thoughts align with the intention of his law. In other words, with all of God's laws, the literal wording of the law is nothing more than a starting point. It's where you begin on a journey into understanding the mind of God. And that's what we need to do. We need to understand the mind of God and to align our mind with his mind. Every law of God goes beyond these starting points. It's always a case of these starting points ought you to have done. As in Matthew 23:23. You ought to have done and not neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. Human laws do not function like that. And the process that God leads us through is we need to apply the application of God's laws back towards those two great purposes, love toward God and love toward neighbor. It's not how the human mind thinks. The human mind likes to set parameters within which it is safe to operate, whereas the law of God is limitless and it covers every possible situation throughout the universe. Earlier, I mentioned that human laws were established as they are perceived to be needed. By contrast, God's laws were established before they were needed. This is because all of God's law together are nothing more than the amplification of the two great principles. God the Father and Jesus Christ have always existed. And these two principles are nothing more than a manifestation of their inherent natures. These two principles express the mind of God and what it's like. And because God the Father and Jesus Christ have identical minds, therefore they always reach identical decisions and conclusions. So they don't need any laws to regulate conduct between themselves. When new circumstances come about, then God the Father and Jesus Christ have identical responses to those new circumstances, and they don't need new laws to deal with those circumstances. However, other beings, human beings, angelic beings, we have free, independent minds, and God will not enforce something in our mind. If we choose to think this, he will not say you can't do that, other than in the scriptures, and we're supposed to take what we think and align it with the Holy Scripture. We don't have inherently that same kind of mind as God the Father has. Therefore, when God formulated certain laws, he formulated them to lead these created beings with independent minds to the point where their free mind, total free will then also always reach the same decisions and assessments that the mind of God reaches in any possible future situation. The righteous angels of God have already completed this training. And we of human beings that have been called are in the process of dealing with God's way of training our minds. God's plan of salvation involves testing and training free, independent human minds to willingly and voluntarily adopt God's way of thinking. When that is achieved, then our human minds will work in the way that is identical to the way that God's mind works. Obedience to all of God's laws is one major tool in this training process, because God's law are an expression of God's mind. But human minds can only be trained if they are forced to make decisions. Telling human beings, here's what you can do, and there's what you cannot do, has zero training effect. This approach can condition, but it cannot train the mind to correctly deal with new conditions in the future. Our Christian life is one of making decisions. With human laws, the laws decide for you what you can and cannot do. And when new circumstances come about, in other words, the internet's invented, then new laws must be created to deal with these new circumstances. How to deal with internet crime. So you got to have new laws to do that and correct that, try to regulate it. By contrast, God's laws force us to constantly make our own decisions. By evaluating for ourselves all the circumstances that are against the two great principles of God's law, any and all new circumstances that arise are already covered by the existing law of God. So with God, no new laws are ever needed. Never needed. Thus, the invention of the internet or all other circumstances are already covered by the two principles. Throwing rocks off a bridge onto a passing car is already covered by the first two principles of God. What is needed when new circumstances arise is to correctly apply the two great principles of these circumstances. With human laws, the laws decide for you what you can and cannot do. And when new circumstances come about, new laws are made. What is needed is learning to correctly apply the two great principles to all the new circumstances. We must learn to adapt the existing laws of God so that those existing laws can correctly be applied to new circumstances. We must apply the principles of the existing laws of God to the new circumstances. For all future eternity, there will only be two laws that will govern the entire family of God and the entire creation. The first law is that we must love God above all else. And the second law is that we love every other individual as we love ourselves. Throughout future eternity, many, many new circumstances will arise because God will never stop creating. And whatever those new circumstances may turn out to be, those two laws will apply to those new circumstances. no new laws will be added or needed. Rather, adapting those two laws to new circumstances will require all of us to constantly make decisions. And that is why it is so important that we become one with one another, and especially one with God, the Father, and with Jesus Christ. John chapter 17, verses 11, 22, and 23. If we are not one with God at that point in time, we would assuredly make wrong decisions in those new circumstances, and wrong decisions will result in sin. Laws are for those who are not one with God. And so laws are required in this present age because humanity is assuredly not one with God. And if we look at society around us, we see easily that society is going away from God in every possible aspect. The further away from becoming one or being one with God a people are, the more laws they need as clear bounds for what they may do. And the additional laws these people will need will be aimed at putting two great principles. Well, they'll need to be aimed at putting the two great principles into practice, or new changed circumstances for minds that don't think like God. The future eternity that God's planned for his family is not possible if any member of the family is not at one with God. In exactly the same way that God the Father and Jesus Christ are one right now. The glory which you gave to me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. John chapter 17, verse 22. Achieving this oneness is absolute requirement for achieving God's intention for the family of God. If God ever, at any point in the future, eternally, has to make some new laws for his family, then it will be impossible to ever achieve oneness in the family of God. We have to do it now. We have to become at one with God the Father and Jesus Christ through the use of our mind and what we choose to do and how we control our mind. Achieving this oneness is an absolute requirement. Any necessity for new laws would imply that someone in the family of God might say or do or think something wrong, which we do pretty regularly, and we have to bring ourselves back into alignment. Unless the new law is established, if there is ever even the possibility that someone in the family of God might say or think or do something wrong, would be just like Satan had done at some point before the creation of man, when oneness is not possible. But the scripture says, those who are born of God cannot sin. I had thought, there's a lot of people out here in the world and in the religious society, Church of God even, that say, I'm the only one that's right. I'm the leader, line up right here. My particular approach to an individual says, I'm the only one. You got to do like I say. As I get on my bicycle and I book it, I'm out of there. I'm not lining up on somebody that claims they're the only one. Think of the example if, and I'm including myself in this, but if anyone on the face of the earth in the Church of God comes up in the resurrection and he has done everything perfect. Put a name to whoever if you want that claims to be they're the only ones. But if a man or a woman comes up in the kingdom of God in the resurrection and he knows in his head that he's always done correctly since he came into church. And, you know, Jesus Christ and him are kind of buddies. But what's going to happen some number of years after the resurrection? Pretty soon this guy that had it all right, he's going to say, hey, Dick, why didn't you follow me? I had everything right. You knew what I was teaching. It was everything. Why didn't you follow me? and you would have instantly another Satan, because that's what he did. He said, I'm perfect. I'm right. Why don't you line up here, follow me? And he got a third of the righteous angels to go over to his side, to the dark side, if you want. And God's not going to put up with that. So I think, and this is just a Dick Close, Richard Close opinion, we're all going to have something wrong with us when we're resurrected. We're going to have a flaw somewhere that we would not be able to say that in the presence of God and Father and Jesus Christ. And then in that way, God would prevent someone starting down the same path early on as Satan went down. Let's look at, in conclusion, the differences between the laws of God and man's laws. With the laws of man, the literal wording of the law is the most important thing. The criterion is always, here is what the law says. And it is the letter of the law that is the most important. The underlying intentions of the, for the establishment of that law may or may not be taken into consideration when a judgment is reached. And different lawyers looking at the same laws frequently reach different conclusions. The laws of man do not concern themselves with how people think, how people's mind work, and with man's law, there's always a need for new laws wherever new circumstances come about. New circumstances are not covered by existing laws. So the establishment of man's laws is an endless process. In contrast, the laws of God are directed first and foremost at how we think, how we use our mind. It is the mind that has to love God above all else and to love everyone else equal to the love for self. With God's law is always the spirit of law, the underlying intention for the law that is most important. And if any disagreement between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, it is always the spirit of the law that takes priority over the letter of the law. Without going into details, some examples of this priority are when David and his men ate the showbread that was intended for the priest. Mouth's getting dry. When Jesus Christ healed people on the Sabbath, and when hungry disciples picked some ears of wheat on the Sabbath for immediate consumption. As the Apostle Paul explained, God, who has made us able ministers of the New Testament and of the letter, not of the Spirit, for the letter kills and the Spirit gives life. We are ministers, not me, but ministers of the Spirit because we are supposedly to always apply the Spirit of the law. God's underlying intentions for the law apply to every, need to be applied to every situation. So God's laws require us to constantly make decisions based on the way of thinking employed by our minds. With God's laws, decisions are never made for us. And when those new circumstances come about, then God does not establish new laws. Instead, the two great principles are adapted to apply to those new circumstances, requiring the decisions on our part. Laws of the world are to tell you what to do. God's laws, in the spiritual sense, tells us how to think and how to come to the point where we have the mind of Christ. And that's what's important. God wants to know how we are thinking. The two great principles are adapted to apply to those new circumstances, requiring more decisions on our part. So when something new comes up we're not familiar with, of course, counsel with the ministry, but also go as far as you can on your own in thinking how you can apply the two great principles and the Ten Commandments, which were, the scripture says, hang from the two great principles. That's a whole sermon in itself. So when seeking to apply God's laws in our lives today, we shouldn't be looking for the do's and the don'ts. And everybody, when you first come into the church, looks at the do's and the don'ts. because humanly we want to know, you know, this is a parameter, I don't want to step over there, because it says don't do that. And most of the time you shouldn't do that. But when you come up with situations that are not clear cut in the scriptures, God wants us to think. He wants us to analyze. He wants us to look at the two great principles, the extension of those principles, which are the Ten Commandments, and apply them in every aspect of our life. We must never forget that with God's laws, the underlying intentions are always more important than the wording, the literal wording of the law. As Jesus Christ showed in the Sermon on the Mount, for God's laws, the literal wording is always only the starting point for the application of those laws. They always cover far more ground than what is expressed by the wording of the law. A little different thinking, but I'm very sure that it's biblical.